Why do we produce the IMC Radio News?
Because the chasm isn't left to right. It's top to bottom.
To give voice to people who aren't heard.
To bust up the myth of objective journalism.
Bill O'Reilly does not have a monopoly on the truth.
To build our community and re-educate the public.
To revive the voice of organized labor.
To bring forth debate so as to animate democracy.
Because I want to agitate for revolution.
Listen to the voices of your community on IMC Radio News.
This week on IMC Radio News, the possible impact of proposed changes in laws protecting national forests, and a narrative of resistance to war in Spain. But first, these headlines.
The Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center reports that about 400 home care workers who are members of SEIU Local 880 rallied on April 3rd in the Capitol Rotunda in Springfield, Illinois, in support of a $1 an hour wage increase. Bill 1179, which provides for an increase to $8 an hour on July 1st of this year and $9 an hour in January of 2004, has passed the House and is awaiting action in the Senate, where previous proposals have died. With the new Democratic majority in the Senate, supporters are hopeful that it will pass, especially since Governor Blagojevich has issued an executive order granting collective bargaining rights to home care workers.
The following headline was taken from IndyMedia.org. Oil fuels war, but the struggle for water is likely to make it worse as states are competing for scarce water supplies and companies see it as a commodity for profiting from the poor. From March 16th to March 23rd at the Third World Water Forum, thousands of delegates discussed if water is to be a basic human right or a commodity owned by private companies. While most of the delegates were corporate representatives with vested interests in privatization, there was a separate grassroots presence as well. However, while the end text could not give a final resolution to this question, water is already a $400 million business. Consequences of water privatization in the South can be seen in Argentina, Bolivia, and South Africa, where prices have risen and quality has dropped. But given the recent decision by the world's largest water company, Suez, to pull out of major cities in the South, and the growing opposition to water privatization in many countries, there are signs that the tide may be turning for the corporate water giants, Corporate Europe Observatory says in one of its recent water briefings. However, Western countries are also seeking the privatization of water through the WTO General Agreement on Trades and Services, GATS. The future of water supplies, however, will be better off if maintenance is done in a participatory way by the people themselves, according to articles in the Green Pepper.
The following headline was taken from the Urbana-Champaign IMC website. The fighting is not completely over in the Iraqi city of Umm Qasr, but the Bush administration is rushing ahead with plans to reopen that key Persian Gulf port. The Corporate Research Project reported that on Monday night, the U.S. Agency for International Development awarded an American company a $5 million contract to manage the seaport. Contractor chosen is Stevedoring Services of America, the Seattle-based port operator that played a leading role in the fall 2002 lockout of longshore workers up and down the west coast of the United States. George Bush threatened to use the U.S. military as replacement workers in the ports before a contract settlement was reached. War planners believe that Umm Qasr is essential to the invasion of Iraq because food, medicine, and other supplies can be delivered through the port. Stevedoring Services of America has never worked in a war zone before. The Corporate Research Project is following the privatization of the spoils of war, and the reports can be found at www.corp-research.org.
The Miami Herald reports that in Camp Bushmaster, Iraq, if you are a soldier who wants to take a bath, you must first agree to be baptized. Army Chaplain Josh Lano of Houston has the only bathtub in the entire base, and he will let people use it only on one condition. Quote, it's simple. They want water. I have it as long as they agree to get baptized. End quote. Before baptism, soldiers must listen to the Southern Baptist chaplain's hour-and-a-half sermon. Chaplain Yano is unconflicted about fighting in Iraq and quotes the Bible in defense of his view. Quote, give unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's and unto God the things that are God's. End quote. Since those in the military have been called up by their government, following orders is giving unto Caesar.
According to IndyMedia.org, activists are targeting the mainstream media for its pro-war bias on the invasion of Iraq. In the UK, on April Fool's Day in Manchester, 30 people occupied the News International office, which runs the Times and the Sun. Once inside, they handed out literature to the staff before being painfully removed. In London, a protest outside the BBC was met with a line of police preventing access. The above actions followed a demonstration outside the Manchester BBC offices, which saw marches converge on the headquarters. Earlier last week, BBC deputy editor Mark Damazar was confronted with a barrage of questions at a public discussion organized by Media Workers Against the War, criticizing the pro-government war-led agenda. In the U.S., Fox News and CNN's New York City bureaus experienced their own April Fool's joke. In Washington, D.C., Code Pink also protested the faux news of Fox News. In Los Angeles, thousands came out to protest CNN's pro-war cheerleading. There were also actions in San Francisco in front of CNN and The Chronicle, as well as a pie in the face for a local talking head.
Those are the headlines for today. Thanks to Kevin for gathering them and reading them here at WEFT. You can contribute headlines for the show by email at newsroom@ucimc.org. National forests are being threatened by proposed changes in the National Forest Management Act. IMC reporter Sam Packard has the story.
The Shawnee National Forest of Southern Illinois is one of 155 national forests and boasts 270,000 acres of both recreational land and wilderness, which serve as a home for 520 different species of animals, including 253 species of birds. Now, would you like to see all this go to the hands of the timber industry? Well, neither does Matt Ewing. Matt Ewing is the Illinois field organizer for the Defenders of Wildlife, an organization which boasts more than 500,000 members nationwide. He was in town this week, and he stopped by the IMC to share with me what's going on in Washington right now. So what is the major thing that you guys are focused on right now?
Right now, we're really focused on national forests. Specifically, we're focused on the National Forest Management Act. This is one of the nation's bedrock environmental laws, and the Bush administration is currently trying to destroy it. So we're really focused on making sure that this law is protected and that the Bush administration does not endanger the future of our national forests.
So what exactly is the National Forest Management Act?
Basically, the National Forest Management Act decides the playing field. It decides if our national forests are going to be there for millions of Americans to enjoy as great wilderness areas, as great recreation areas, or whether they're going to be there for timber industries and mining companies to take advantage of. A strong National Forest Management Act is really essential to ensure that our national forests are protected for future generations to enjoy.
So the Bush administration, what exactly are they doing with this? What are they doing to endanger this law?
The Bush administration has proposed new regulations regarding the National Forest Management Act. What this means is that they are rewriting the National Forest Management Act. This has been done several times. It's normal for a law to be updated. However, instead of taking this law forward, they're actually taking a giant step backwards.
And how are they doing that?
Right now, one of the most powerful aspects of the National Forest Management Act is that the public can broadly participate. For instance, right now in southern Illinois, the Shawnee National Forest is creating a new National Forest Plan. There's a whole wide range of stakeholders that are talking about what they would like to see the forest look like. Some people would like to see more horse trails. Some people would like to see more wilderness. Some people would like to see more ATV trails. Personally, I don't agree with everyone, but I think it's really a powerful aspect of this planning process that everyone gets to have a really powerful way to contribute to the process to make sure that their voice is heard. The Bush administration is trying to curtail this avenue. They are going to limit the public comment period. They're going to make it so the information regarding public comment periods is less widespread, and they're going to limit the ways in which people can publicly comment. With this new plan, you would no longer be able to go on the internet and sign an online petition. You'd no longer be able to fill out a postcard. You would basically have to go to one of these meetings in southern Illinois yourself to have any meaningful role in this decision-making process. This is really at heart an anti-democratic move.
Wow, that's pretty bold, almost disturbing.
As disturbing is they're really trying to do their best to make science stand by the side, trying to make sure that scientists do not have a real role in these decisions. Right now, the current law requires independent scientific review, meaning that outside scientists take a look at the forest plan and see if it's actually going to do what they say it's going to do. They do environmental impact studies to see if there's a way that we could meet these goals with less environmental damage. These would be optional under the new rule. This is the first time in 25 years that revisions have been made to the National Forest Management Act without consulting an independent body of scientists. Ronald Reagan talked to an outside panel of scientists. Bush administration is not. Instead, they are relying on Mark Rae, the head of the Forest Service under Bush. Mark Rae spent 18 years as the lead lobbyist for the timber industry. Our forests are not safe in his hands.
Well, that sounds like there are some pretty clear conflicts of interest here.
There are. The unfortunate history of the Forest Service has been a revolving door between the timber industry and the Forest Service. This is why the National Forest Management Act was created in the first place, to put checks and balances to ensure that they don't harvest away our national forests. Bush administration is essentially giving the timber industry their wish list by getting rid of these checks and balances.
So while this isn't something that every American knows about, but this is something that's pretty important.
Mm-hmm. Well, the National Forest Management Act is certainly a mouthful and not something that people talk about every day. It really is the overarching piece of policy that decides how every single one of our 155 national forests are managed. This is going to decide what they look like, and it's also going to decide what role the public has in managing our own forests.
All right. Okay, so people hear this, people hear the program, and they say, wow, I didn't know about this. This is really important. I want to do something. I want to get involved. What's a good way to start?
So one of the best ways to get involved is to go to www.savenationalforests.org. There you can fill out a public comment card and learn a lot more information about the issue.
So you can go to the website, and from there, I guess you can send a comment directly to the Department of Agriculture, and there's a deadline for this.
That is exactly right. April 7th is the last and final chance to voice your opinion on this act. It's your last chance to tell the Department of Agriculture that you do not want this new proposal, that you want to have a role in this, and you want scientists to have a role in this.
All right, guys, you heard it from him. The deadline for this is today. So go to www.savenationalforests.org and tell the government what you think. Thank you for listening, and this is Sam for IMC Radio News.
They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum, and they charged the people $1.50 just to see them. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
Joni Mitchell here on IMC Radio News. Walter Matherly, whom you can sometimes hear on Monday evenings at 7 p.m. on Champaign-Urbana Radio Theater, provides us with the following narrative of music, resistance, poetry, and hope, compiled from his experiences during a recent trip to Spain.
Manifiéstate el jueves día 13 a las 8 de la tarde. No a la guerra.
I've been to Spain for the month of February, 3 years running now. I just got off the plane a couple of weeks ago. It's mainly the language that draws me. I speak and understand it reasonably well and find it a window of delight into a culture that is challenging, inventive, and different from the Midwestern United States where my family and I presently live. In past years, I've read a good bit of the history of Spain and Portugal, their Muslim inheritance, their ties to the Roman Catholic Church and the Habsburg and Mob and Bourbon monarchies, their struggle for democracy, and the impact the Iberian Peninsula itself has had on Europe and the Near East. Also, I wanted to hear more music this time, especially the classical and folk heritage so many Spanish localities encourage and enjoy. I find music forming a sort of Ariadne's thread leading back to remembered encounters and people from this year's trip.
Ante la gravedad de la situación, paremos la guerra.
What you hear under my voice now is a promo tape played tirelessly over sound truck loudspeakers. These two voices are Eloina, 30-something-year-old secretary of the UGT Sindicato, or Coalition of Trade Unions, and Jorge, a member of a carpenter's local, two perhaps of a couple of dozen volunteer organizers of the protest march in the city of León, a city lying in the Altiplano a few hours north of Madrid by bus.
El jueves día 13 a las 8 de la tarde.
The night of the event, Thursday the 13th of February, people began to gather well before the prescribed hour of 8 p.m. and on their own started walking around the Plaza Inmaculada, encircling a gorgeous lighted fountain in the center of the city. Marshaled by a surprisingly small group of organizers, all without bullhorns, we made a last circuit of the Inmaculada and set off on a triangular route, about a kilometer on a side, around the two major plazas of the city, Santiago Domingo and Guzman, each connected to the other by two broad thoroughfares. We passed the intercity and local buses in order to sweep up late arrivals. I wandered among the marchers, saying hello, asking questions, chatting. To my surprise, I found at least three-quarters of them to be families. Mother, father, kids, grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, most of whom had planned the event by telephone during the week before. I'd expected the angry, ecstatic crowd of young activists one could anticipate at home here in the United States, quaffing beer and shouting slogans. This gathering was different. Nearly everyone carried a placard, but the most arresting of them were the crude images drawn in crayon and poster paint prepared by the children in their schools. One showed bombs raining from the sky. Another one said, "No, Señor Bush, no a la guerra." Another, "Que se manden Bush, Aznar y Blair a Iraq." Send Bush, Aznar, and Blair to Iraq. The sindicatos were marching behind their banners, arms linked, singing songs everyone seemed to know by heart, heavily favoring Joan Baez's No Nos Moverán from revolutionary Cuba half a century ago. Also in evidence were the socialists and the anarchists, political parties and still forces in the north of Spain, in Barcelona, and in Madrid, going back to the Spanish Civil War and to the revolutions of 1848. The crowd continued to swell. The León police and the organizers of the march did something unusual in U.S. protests. In the next day's papers, they came close to agreeing on the peak numbers of the marchers, 18,000 and 20,000 respectively. By 9 o'clock, parents began to drift away to the queues at bus stops for their rides home, babes in arms asleep, older children drowsy and irritable. The university crowd filed off for nightcaps of vino tinto. On Saturday the 15th, I took the noon train to Oviedo, capital of Asturias province. The Oviedo unions had chosen that day for their march, as had most of the communities of Spain. Consequently, passengers stepped out of the station right into the middle of another manifestación, this time a bigger, heavily university-oriented city. The crowd had ascended to 100,000, heavily students, a little rowdier, noisier this time. Still, families formed the biggest portion of the crowd. It was the following day, however, Sunday, that held the most moving event of the Oviedo leg of my trip. It was here that the roots of family feeling regarding the Guerra Bushista in the north were brought home to me. Oviedo, ravaged by the Civil War nearly 60 years ago, lies less than 100 kilometers west of Guernica, the village made famous by Picasso's painting of the agonies of war. It was in Guernica that anti-personnel bombs for the first time in modern warfare were dropped on civilians from the air. The event that absorbed my attention, however, was small, domestic even. At 1 o'clock Sunday afternoon, a group of local people devoted to preserving Asturian folk music and dance, calling themselves Prima Danza, gathered as they do each Sunday in a quiet corner of the old city at a monument called La Paraguas. It is a gigantic umbrella made of bronze, erected earlier in the century as a piece of sheltering public art. The event was not coordinated with anything national or even regional. 20 or 30 family groups, most of whom had come to the city from villages around Oviedo, many for the march of the day before, clustered in the open space surrounding the monument. Promptly at 1 o'clock, everyone, big and little, formed a circle under the umbrella and around its stem, with pinkies linked, and began a slow left-to-right circular dance. I inserted myself between a mother and with a baby on her back and her 7-year-old daughter, who shared the task of teaching me the step. After we'd gathered a little speed, the dance leader led us in the singing of an Asturian lament sung in minor key in the tempo of our dancing. When the singing of verses from memory began to run down, the leader, a teacher type of about 40 years old, took out a piece of paper with an additional 11 verses and a refrain printed on it in modern Spanish. As the singing became more intelligible, what we heard were verses to the ancient song that had been composed in school during the previous week by the children dancing in the group. Each young author was encouraged to solo for their particular verse, but all of us joined in on the refrain. I was considerably shaken. I found the verses and the refrain bringing involuntary tears to my eyes. The following two verses and refrain were almost more than I could bear. With Asnar and with Blair and also with this man Bush, humanity is going to suffer more than Jesus upon the cross. And in this war of numbers and protests, I don't know if I'll be counted among the living or among the dead. And then the refrain. To all of you against wars, I must say to you, we all die in the same way. It will always be like this. Yesterday, Spaniards, today, the Iraqi people, tomorrow, others of the poor. It will always be like this. When the dancing was over, the group broke up and headed for home. But before I was allowed to leave, I was soundly kissed by the 7-year-old, her mother, and her father. After spending a week among friends in Gijón on the shore of the Bay of Biscay, only a few kilometers north of Oviedo, I went to Burgos. Here and in Gijón, I was to learn about a powerful Spanish custom, the tertulia. The tertulia is a free-form conversation, a discussion, debate, chat, conducted among acquaintances, generally over coffee or a glass of wine, and usually with a purpose in mind. A tertulia often has a literary, academic, or artistic intent. In Gijón, the previous week, I'd found myself in the midst of a tertulia conducted regularly by 7 elderly brothers, the father and uncles of a good Gijonese friend. The avocation of all 7, a doctor, 2 lawyers, a retired chemist, a teacher, a contractor, a bureaucrat, is the study of history and the development of opinions, often quite divergent, about its meaning and importance. In the course of discussion, wild, loud, contentious, very articulate, the importance of the past to the people of northern Spain and to the wealthy city of Burgos in particular began to surface. It was in Burgos that the liberal Republican coalition, popularly elected in Spain early in the 1930s, met its first defeat. Interested, I decided I needed to see it for myself. I arrived in Burgos on a wet, windy evening. Leaning into the wind, I crossed the bridge leading into the older portion of the city and crossed the Arlanzón River, swollen by an early spring thaw. An elderly gentleman in a black Homburg and a black wool overcoat, frosted with the cold rain, drew abreast of me to wait for a traffic light. Do you perhaps know where the Hotel Cordon is? I asked tentatively. Well, I should hope I do, he boomed. It's owned by my best friend, Venga. He grabbed my arm at the elbow, and off we went into the teeth of a driving rain. He stopped walking for a moment in front of the hotel and fixed me with a frigid 85-year-old gaze and growled, "What do you think of your president's new war?" I spat out my best Spanish invective against Bush's war, but before I could finish the sentence, he threw his arms about me, gave me a rough abrazo, and marched me inside. Asking around about music, I discovered that the city of Burgos was that week hosting performances of the works of Antonio José Martínez y Palacios, a composing prodigy born in Burgos in 1902 by a famous organist from Malaga. The music was to be performed upon a superb new organ of German design in the Church of San Lesmes, an ancient church named for the 10th century patron of the city of Burgos. Martinez is called simply by his given names, Antonio José, a mix of familiarity, respect, and public reverence. Just as his life and work are celebrated, Antonio José's death has special meaning for Burgolesos as well. Fresh out of the Burgos Conservatory and riding the crest of a reputation as a prodigious composer and master performer, he taught piano and organ at the cathedral in Malaga for 6 years. He was eventually seduced back to the city of his birth in 1930, where he was chosen at an early age to lead the conservatory. Also in 1930, in the aftermath of the death of dictator Primo Rivera, political conflict in Burgos became pronounced, and factions rapidly formed and hardened. A series of special regulations were decreed by the Guardia Civil to allow detention of liberals accused of activities opposing the Guardia's local influence. Antonio José, in the company of a number of other leading liberals, had formed La Tertulia del Ciprés. They met regularly in a coffee shop on Thursday evenings, attempting, as a historian of the region relates, to find ways to invigorate the life of the city and prepare it to receive fresh, new ideas. The fascists seized power in Burgos in July of 1936, making it the first city in Spain to revolt against the elected national government. A number of liberal activists, among them Antonio José, were detained in the Burgos prison. Sometime during the night between October 8th and October 9th, Antonio José, 36-year-old composer and music teacher, was led into the courtyard of the prison with six of his colleagues and shot to death by a Falangist firing squad. The poet Federico García Lorca had been similarly gunned down near Granada, August the 19th. The enormity of the crime of murdering artists in pursuit of political ends contributed to the international outrage that eventually isolated Franco and fueled European and American resistance to fascism. Walking back to the hotel from the concert at San Lesmes in an icy drizzle, my memory fed helplessly on the so-called un-American activities, hearings conducted by Joe McCarthy and Roy Cohn in Washington in the 1950s that indicted a long roster of American artists and writers. Are we in danger of it happening again under the provisions of the Patriots Act recently promulgated by the Bush administration and by the onset of the war in Iraq? The administration will, of course, respond to liberal complaints of infringed human rights. But this is war! Where is your patriotism, your regard for your flag and your country? It has already started. As I walked in the night wind, I was hearing, "No a la guerra," followed closely by the refrain, "Yesterday Spaniards, today the Iraqi people, tomorrow, others of the poor." It will always be like this.
And that concludes IMC Radio News for this week. Contributors include Sam Packard, Walter Matherly, and Kevin Heinrich. Anyone can be involved in the creation of this show, and no experience is necessary. Just email radio@ucimc.org or call 344-8820 extension 1. Archives of this program are available on the IMC website, www.ucimc.org. Thank you for listening, and take care.